Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting our regular chat sessions with Kelly Gottlieb, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto. Kelly is one of the most significant contributors to computing education, the profession, and industry worldwide. Kelly, thank you for coming in today to share your insights with the audience.
Well, I'm glad I still have some memory to give.
Well, Kelly, I find you just an amazing person and pioneer, and today we're going to talk about some of your contributions and some of the stories you have surrounding the Second World War. So, and what year did you get involved, and you were in your third year of university?
The first time I got involved, I was still an undergraduate at university, and that would have been in 1941. When in my third year, we were asked if, in physics, we were asked if we would be willing to help teach, this was in Canada, help teach airmen who were going to a very secret radar course. But before they learned about radar, they had to learn about electricity and magnetism. And we were third-year honor physics students, and we knew all about that. So I signed up, and I did go to University of Guelph. I was going to Toronto, but of course was held at Guelph. And we taught enlisted airmen who had just enlisted and were taking their first course in electricity and magnetism, after which they would learn about radar, which, of course, was very secret and we knew what it was, but what it did, but not how it worked. So I spent the summer in Guelph with two other colleagues, teaching students. And one interesting thing is that I think there was only one student in the class who was as young as I was. Everyone else in the class was older than me. But it was a good summer. There were some faculty at Guelph on it, and I had two colleagues whose name I remember, and I kept contact with them for many years after the war. I think they're not alive now, and because they were my own age. That was 1941, so I was 20 at the time. So that was the first thing. And I've got stories. And then when I graduated, we still had, because we were in the scientific discipline, we had deferment from having to go into the army. Applied for a job working at the university, on a very, very secret project called the Proximity Fuse Project. And the proximity fuse, the fuse is a device in the front of an aircraft, of a shell, that determines how long it is before it goes off. And essentially, all fuses, artillery fuses, are powder trains. They burn around in a circle for a certain time, and then at the end they light a detonator. But the proximity fuse, which is an idea that originated in England, but they didn't have the manpower and so on to pursue it, has a little radio in it, a radio oscillator. These were very small vacuum tubes, and they were encased in wax because they had to withstand the firing of the gun. Oh, they were used for anti-aircraft guns, particularly, and the point is that an aircraft shell is about the right size, that if you get the right frequency, a high frequency of the oscillator, it has a dipole, it looks like a butterfly, its radiation pattern. So if the shell is not sensitive, if it's going directly to the aircraft, it has a low sensitivity and it doesn't go off. But if the shell is going sideways past and it's not going to hit the aircraft anyway, then it has a high sensitivity, it goes off. So it has a kind of double chance of, of being effective. If it's going to be close, it waits. If it's going to be far away, it goes off anyway, and the chance that a fragment will hit. So they were very, very effective. That was one thing. The other thing is that they needed batteries to power the shell, the radio, and these batteries had to have a long shelf life. And an idea that was actually invented in Canada, and the thing that went into final instruction, they had a small cylinder plate and an ampule of sulfuric acid. And when the explosion, when the aircraft went, when the thing was fired, the ampule would break, and the rotation of the shell would spin the sulfuric acid and activate the battery. So the battery really wasn't working at all while it was just being stored. But just when it was being fired, it became active, and that was very important in military conditions. So these were very good ideas, but there are many problems about it. For one thing, the radio had to be very stable, and the battery, if there are any fluctuations in voltage because of the spin, then those fluctuations would look like an aircraft and they would go off prematurely. So the whole thing needed an enormous amount of research work. And the research work was going on in the United States, and mainly at Johns Hopkins University, and in Canada at the University of Toronto. And we were testing them, and eventually they went into production, about 1943. This was 42, and I joined the project in 42. It had been going on for a while. And they didn't work until the Americans started producing sort of millions of them, because then you get quality control. The ones we made were very sort of one-off, and if you had small variations in the size of the plate of the battery or things like that, they weren't reliable. So they need a lot of testing, and when I joined the project, we tested them in Camp Borden. We would go up to the military camp and with the event, and they were going to be used mostly for anti-aircraft gun, but we were using 25-pounders that were not anti-aircraft gun, so we propped up the gun to shoot up. And the sergeant in charge said, "You can't do that. You don't have any range tables. I mean, we don't know what happens when you take a gun which is designed to operate at 45 degrees and you're doing it at 80 degrees. We said, "Oh, no, we're mathematicians. We're physicists. We can calculate range tables." So we did. Now, the ones we tested, the shells had these fuses, but of course they didn't have high explosives. They were real shells with real fuses, but no high explosives. So we would fire these almost vertically and then recover them to see whether they had survived, the tubes that survived and things like this. But our range tables, the thing that we calculated, we had no knowledge of the upper winds, the upper atmosphere. So if you fired it almost straight up, and there are winds up there which you didn't know about, they would take these shells in all kinds of places that you didn't know. So we sat in dugouts with steel plates and sandbags, and we would wait for these shells to come down, and we would detonate them by sending up a radio signal, the aircraft, You could hear these shells coming down for more than a minute. They would be screaming as they came down. You see, they wouldn't turn over. They'd go straight up and then come down. And you could hear them scream for a minute. And about every 12th one would hit the dugout, with a loud thud. And of course the artillery sergeants who fired the guns for us, because we were all civilians, they had a very low opinion of our calculations, for good reason, because you'd need upper air winds in order to make correction for where they would land. So we did quite a lot of that, improving them slowly, and going down to the United States, consulting with the Americans and Johns Hopkins University. I made several trips to Washington. It is very high security clearances. And the Americans finally got into it too, and we got the batteries working and everything working, and the Americans started making millions of these. And they were quite successful as anti-aircraft guns, so the British decided they'd better have some too. But the British guns were different sizes than the American guns, and the shells were different sizes. So you had to put in oscillators of different frequencies because these were dipole. So we were the Canadians asked if we would be willing to go over to England to help test these things in British guns. And there are three of us who were working. I said, listen, this is a war effort, and yes, we'd be willing to go. So that's the background. That's only the background. So I have three separate stories, if you have time for them, on my going there and being there during the test and coming back. Do you want to stop for a minute? Because have you got enough time to listen to all this?
Sure, absolutely. So I guess there's some, what you're saying then is you have some interesting stories with regards to the British Navy during the war.
Yeah.
And then your trip in 1943 to England in a Liberator bomber, and then your trip back and return in 1944 on the Isle de France ocean liner.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's start with going over. So we went in a Liberator bomber, and the Liberator was a bomber that had a plastic bubble in the tail where the tail gunner sat. Because it was a bomber, it was a plane in which all the VIPs and politicians and so on went back and forth from England, because ships were slow, convoys. So the trip to England, we were given sort of VIP status and to go over and liberate a bomber. Now, at that time, that was 1943, so I was 22, but I've always looked younger my age, so I looked about 16. And also, the bomber didn't have seats. It had mattresses, so you had these big, bulky flying suits to keep you warm, because they flew at about 11,000 feet, and you lay on the mattresses as you flew across. It took, for weather and other conditions, we were in Montreal in Gander, actually. In the first time we went, the weather wasn't good, and we came back. But eventually, we got clearance to make the flight. So I was dressed in a big, bulky, flying suit and making my way toward the aircraft. And as I say, I was 22, but I looked about 16. So I kept being stopped by security, saying, you know, because everybody else were VIPs, diplomats and senior military people. And they say, you know, what is this kid doing here? And so I said, well, I'm going over to England because I was asked to go. So eventually they accepted my credentials. And just as I was going in, the captain was talking to the navigator. And he said, you know, he says, I wish we don't have the same problem we had in our last trip, because there were some rumors of enemy aircraft. Instead of flying at 10,000 feet, I had to go up to 12,000. And we had oxygen in the crew, but the passengers didn't, so they passed out because we had to stay up so long. So I hope that doesn't happen. And I don't know to this day whether this was a joke for my benefit or the truth, but it certainly made it for a kind of, a worry about this flight. And the other thing about that flight was that the toilet was in the bubble, in this plastic, clear plastic bubble in the tail. And if you had to go, and instantly it was a 10-hour flight to Glasgow, to what is it, the airport near Glasgow, I've forgotten the big airport. So you know, there was a pretty good chance you'd have to go to the toilet, and I did one. And when you got into this plastic bubble, and it was June the 21st, the middle of summer, we were 10,000 feet. And it was the most wonderful sky I've ever seen in all my life. Every constellation and star that you could see on a clear night was there. The Milky Way. I can close my eyes and see it now. It only happened once. It was such a marvelous experience sitting suspended below the aircraft, and in every direction you could see the universe. So that was a very beautiful part. It stayed with me all my life as an image of the universe compared to the world in which we live. So that was going over.
So now, I mean, that's a really fascinating story. Well, then
I'll tell. I have lots of memories, but there's one other story that's a bit funny. We did various things. We redesigned the oscillators for the British gun, and then they had to be tested. So they decided to do a test in which the guns would be on a ship in the Irish Sea, and they would fire them into land, and you know, if he were working. So they asked us if we, they asked me, actually, one, we were three of us, but they asked me if I would be willing to be in charge of one of these tests. So naturally, I was there in England and working with the Navy. Everybody else was, either some civilian scientists, local Navy, but naturally, you said, yes, you'll be in charge. So I went to Aberystwyth in Wales, which is on the British side of the North Sea, and the test was to go off one day, and the test was to be coordinated from a merchant ship about 2 miles off Aberystwyth, and radio control, in which we would tell them when to fire, and they would know when to get the shell and so on. But the coordination was to be from this merchant ship. So I spent the night in Aberystwyth and then go out in a little boat out to the North Sea. And it was very choppy. You know, it was choppy up and down, about 2 miles. And by the time we got there, I was on the verge of being seasick. It was just awful. But we get to this merchant ship, and I climb up, and instead of going, up and down, up and down, up and down, it goes roll this way, roll that way. I thought it was better, but it wasn't. So we would be doing these firing trials, and we would fire about 5 rounds, and then I would say, halt the trials. And I'd have to go over to the side and be sick. And everybody else were either sailors or merchant sailors, and they were saying, oh, so sorry, old chap, sorry. But I was the only landlubber. Nobody else was sick except me. So, and I looked, as I say, about 17. So I was in charge of the whole operation, and everybody else had no problem at all with this thing. But I had to call off a trial every 3/4 hour so I could be sick overboard. And I'd be, give up whatever I had to give up and come back, and we'd go on with the firing trial. And that went on, until I had nothing else to give. The test was successful, and the things were in the British, we're using the Navy, but what shall I say, I gave my all to the British Navy.
And much more, indeed. So you have an interesting story in terms of your return to Canada in 1944.
Their return in Canada was a year later, and they asked, we were supposed to go for 3 months, and asked to stay for 6 months, and I did. And then they wanted me to stay longer, but I don't know, I thought I wasn't much good, and so I came back after 9 months. Now, the Île-de-France was a French ship that had won just before the war the Blue Ribbon. That's the prize that's given for the ship that makes the fastest crossing in the Atlantic. So the French, it had made the crossing in 4.5 days, and because of its speed, the Île-de-France didn't travel in a convoy, because it, with its speed, it was able to outrace any submarines. I went up, to Glasgow. Oh, there's several stories. I don't know how much time you've got. I could digress. I remember, well, one thing, you never knew the exact sailing date because it was very secret. The Île-de-France was going to make this, it did make this trip across the Atlantic without speed. And the submarine, this was at a time when the submarines were very active in the thing. So, you had to be very careful. So the sailing date was very secret, and the route was very secret. So we went up for 3 or 4 days, and I would report each day, say, "No, we're not sailing today. We're not sailing today." And finally, but one day I remember, when we were not sailing, I was in Glasgow, and I said, "You can do whatever you wanted. You just walk around." So I said, "I got to visit Loch Lomond. Everybody, it's a nice, everybody knows the song of Loch Lomond." So I went out for a walk, and walking along, skirting Loch Lomond, and some Scotsman comes in, and he starts walking beside me, not saying anything for a while, and then we slowly collect the conversation, and he learns I'm Canadian, and his eyes light up, and he's a great hockey fan, and he knew about the Maple Leafs. So he was so enthusiastic about the Maple Leafs, he wanted to know what it was like to watch a hockey game from Maple Leaf Stadium. Well, I didn't have the heart to tell him that I'd never seen one. So here we were. Well, he knew so much more about hockey and Maple Leafs than I did, and I was, too embarrassed to say that although I live in Toronto, I'd never bothered to see the Maple Leafs in there. But anyway, one finally we get the sail to get off the sail, and it takes about 4.5 days, but we actually the trip took 11 days because it went through a very zigzag path in order to avoid the packs of submarines. And we were in the so-called officers' quarters, which consisted of bunks that held six bunks that held 12 people. All the rest were troop. It was a troop ship going over, and on the way back, it had whoever was coming back. Among other things, it had, for example, the ferry pilots. The ferry pilots were the people who flew American-made bombers over to England, and then came back by ship to pick up some more. And these ferry pilots were civilians, and they're very well paid, and they had a big poke. You weren't allowed to above decks at night at all. You could go above deck sometimes in the daytime. But they had a poker game going the whole 11 days. It didn't quit. But only ferry pilots played because nobody else could afford the stakes. So this poker game was going on with about 40 ferry pilots that went on unbroken. It never stopped during the whole 11 days, while the rest of us, sort of did whatever we could do. But one night, I wake up and something seems funny. And what's funny is that you always heard the throb, throb, throb of the ship's engines. And there were no throbs. And, you know, the fire, those in our cabin say, what is this? Here's a ship that depends on its speed for evading submarines and is sitting still in the middle of the Atlantic. What is all this? Well, we talked among each other, and there's two explanations, both reasonable, but we never were told which one was true. One of them was that they had equipment that could detect the presence of submarines, and the submarine could detect the throb of the ship, so that if there are submarines close, they stop the ship's motors, so the ship wouldn't be picked up by them until the submarine pack left. That's what we figured was one thing. And the other thing that we knew happened, that these sailings were so secret that even the captain wasn't given the whole route. What he was given was a series of envelopes in which he sailed to a certain place at a certain time and then sailed another that was known to be free of submarines and then sailed to another place and finally would get air escort at either end. So that, but if he got sailed to a certain place and was waiting for air escort, and he got there too early, he'd have to wait. So these, you know, those of us in the thing worked out these two explanations as why the ship sat dead silent for 2 hours in the middle of the night, in the middle of the Atlantic, surrounded by submarines, and then we went on, and you know, nothing happened. But they you know, it turned out, as I say, this, we were not the heroes of this story, but we certainly were involved with it.
You know, this is kind of a fascinating time, and you're involved in all of this classified work, and you have these sort of stories that are just part of this journey. What kind of checks were done to you personally to make sure that you were sort of in line with this classified work?
First of all, we were at the top of our class, and I was at the top of my class in science. So first of all, there was a check that you were qualified, and then there were security checks on your family history and so on, because they had to get very high clearance. So I passed on both of those.
So did they do things like talk to your neighbors and friends?
We never knew. The answer is yes. I mean, you know, we knew there were some inquiries. Yeah, absolutely they did. But I mean, nobody would tell us. Every once in a while, some neighbor would mention that they'd had some inquiry.
You worked on these classified projects, and some of them are still classified today, aren't they?
Well, I've got one more story to tell then about this classification. About 15 years after the war, about 1955, while I was at the university, the Defense Research Board was giving grants for, along with National Research Council, to help. I've got two stories, actually. I'll tell this to the Defense Research Board 15 years after, but there's another in between. Anyway, they're giving grants, and the work at the university was unclassified, but they felt that I was invited to and acted as chairman of the board that gave these grants. I was a recipient myself. But I was, there was a little group of universities that the university people that helped distribute. So they reclassified my clearance. They checked that I was still a good citizen in the remaining 15 years, and they gave me a new clearance. And although the work that was done at university was generally unclassified, they felt that it would be good if the chairman of the group would go around to Army installations and see the work that was being done in different army groups just to be aware of what was being done in for defense, and you know, if they had ideas that would contribute. So I was invited to go around to Valcarce and various places, and see what the army was doing in research. And I got to Valcarce, where it turned out one of the research projects was still the proximity fuse. It was still doing it. But the interesting thing was that it was if only 2 weeks had passed. All the work that was being done was exactly just, you know, an immediate follow-up of everything we had done when we last left the project. There would have been absolutely no progress at all. But there was, in between that, there was a thing. While I was still, when I got back to England, we still continued to work on proximity fuse projects. And one of the things that they wanted was they had a particular class of artillery that was very unstable. And it turned out that these were guns. This was during the war still, you see. We got back, the war was still on. These were guns that fired, that had shells with mustard gas in them. Now, during the, mustard gas was used in the First World War, and both countries, both sides decided they wouldn't use it. So it was never used in the Second World War, but nevertheless, Canada and I guess other countries felt that they had to have stock of mustard gas shells in case the other side broke the agreement. So so Canada had these mustard gas shells, which it turned out were very unstable because they have liquid in them. So when the shells are fired, the liquid spins around and makes the shell very erratic. And we had the radios in them, and we could get the signals from these erratic shells. It would be an erratic signal, so we could work out the path of these shells. And of course, if they were going to do anything to improve them, we could know whether they're improving them. So we were sent out to Suffield in Alberta, where these trials were being done on how to improve mustard shells. Now, you can just imagine incidentally, we were back at the university. You can imagine how popular we would have been had the students known that we were working on mustard gas. But at that time, you know, this is what the country wants you to do. That's what you did. So we went out to Suffield and did all these trials in mustard gas. When the war ended, everything we did was still classified. I wanted to continue with my graduate work. I had a BA, but of course I went in right after the BA. So all the experience I had was on this highly classified work. So the physics department and the university decided that they would let me, and the three of us who would work together, they would let us use all this secret work that would be done for our PhD thesis. Now, the whole idea of a PhD thesis at the university is it does research in the public good and it makes it public and it increases society. So secret work, confidential and classified work as a PhD is almost a contradiction of terms. But in addition, of course, it meant that my whole committee had to have security clearances, because when we described our research to our professors, they all had to have clearances. But it went through. They got clearances. And then we had a notice of our PhD, and the notice says, and notice usually gives a description of what the research is, and the notice says, to this day, the notice said, this work is confidential and cannot be revealed, and this was after the war, and you can imagine how popular, again, we would have been had we However, eventually, they allowed us to publish one paper on a lot of the work that they felt was, you know, the fact that you could put shells, you could trace the path of a projectile while it was still in the upper atmosphere by its radio signals and recover it, was really, that was too obvious. There's no use keeping that secret, because the Germans and anybody else would knew by that time that could happen. So they let us publish one paper, which was published in the Canadian Journal of Research, but they never declassified my thesis. So if you go to the University of Toronto now and look up my thesis, you'll still find that it's a classified thesis.
So do you think really the work should be continued to be classified, or?
Well, by this time, any of that work would, you know, could be, for one thing, we had tiny vacuum tubes embedded in wax. Now they still make proximity fusion, but they're all done by transistors, and you know, the whole technology is different. So the chain, I haven't kept up with it, of course, but the fact that you can put radio in shells is clearly, everybody knows that, but the technology we use to do it is so obsolete that there's no, you know, nobody would be interested in the way we did it.
So, Kelly, we're coming to the end of this interview. Do you have any additional sort of stories to tell about the relationships you maintained with your fellow researchers at that time, or with the armed forces officers and other personnel at that time?
I'd have to think about that. Not right now, anyway. I think I've probably exhausted you and myself in part, because I haven't completely recovered from that 101 flu I had 2 days ago. It wasn't flu, it was a flu reaction. But anyway, as I say, that's my collection of war stories, none of which I'm a hero.
Well, Kelly, I mean, the contributions you've made are just tremendous, and you're quite an iconic figure worldwide. So I thank you for coming in today to share your thoughts with our audience.
Well, I'm glad. You know, I tell these stories to my grandchildren, and, you know, as long as I don't repeat them too often, they like them. I have to make sure I only don't tell them more than once in 4 years. But I've never actually committed them to paper.
Well, now we have a record, right?
Yeah. Well, anyway, it means, I will say that I feel I've had a good run.